Next case is 95-1837 and 1938, State of Ohio versus Teresa Thomas. Ms. Wright.
May I please report? I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for my rebuttal. There is no duty to retreat when one's attacked in one's own home. Appellant here, Teresa Thomas, is requesting this court continue to follow the precedent set well over 100 years ago in the State v. Peacock case, which recognized the Castle Doctrine and continue to hold that there is no duty to retreat regardless of the status of the attacker. The central issue in any self-defense case is whether the defendant actually and reasonably believed the given amount of force necessary to prevent the danger of imminent bodily harm. The Castle Doctrine merely is an extension of this standard in that the rule reflects the law's recognition that a person driven from a home has no safer place to which to retreat.
Wasn't the law always that you had a duty to retreat even where they were not cohabitants? When we went to school, but the law of self-defense says you've got the duty to retreat, you can't use legal force until there's no other way out.
That's still the law in the sense of the second element of self-defense.
Okay. If that's still the law, then does cohabitation make that different?
No. Cohabitation does not make it different.
So then she had a duty to retreat?
No. She had a duty. The second element of self-defense requires that you have a reasonable belief of imminent harm and that there is no other means of escape. It requires that there be no other means of escape. But that's something different than imposing a duty to retreat.
I thought your argument here was that because they were cohabitants, in fact, that's what your first proposition of law very clearly states.
There's no duty to retreat between cohabitants.
Because they're cohabitants, she had no duty to retreat. Had they not been cohabitants, she would have had a duty to retreat.
No. My proposition of law speaks to the Court of Appeals decision, which held there was a duty to retreat between cohabitants. The argument is that there is no duty to retreat in one's own home, regardless of whether you are attacked by a cohabitant, an intruder, an invitee, a trespasser. The status of the attacker is not what determines whether you have a duty to retreat. You have no duty to retreat in your own home. It's your ultimate sanctuary, your safe haven.
Or isn't it safe haven from the outside, from intruders, as opposed to how can it really be a safe haven when you share a dwelling?
Well, it can be a safe haven when you share a dwelling if there's no duty to retreat from it when you're attacked by someone that cohabitates.
The whole concept of your home is a safe haven.
Yes.
Is safe from whom? From the outside world.
It's safe from any unlawful attack. A cohabitant that attacks you, that has an equal right to be in the home, but that attacks you, loses the right to be in the home, loses his ability to claim that it's a safe haven for him. Additionally, where are you going to flee to? Are you going to flee outside, and is that safe? No reasonable person should be required to flee outside the home, because it's not safe. We recognize that for hundreds of years. But you lose your status, you lose your right to be in the home once you begin an unlawful attack.
Did you and your client left the room?
Initially, my client left the room.
Went into a bedroom, or into another room.
She went into the bathroom.
Did Flowers follow her into that other room?
No.
She obtained a gun in the other room.
That's correct.
Came back into the room where Flowers was.
Standing between her
so
and the door.
So she retreated out of the room that he was in, went into another room, but voluntarily came back into the room where
She voluntarily came back into the room because there were no means of escape from the bathroom.
She had the gun.
She had the gun.
No,
she didn't pick up the gun until she realized there was no means of escape from the bathroom. The window was too small.
She was trying to escape from the bathroom?
That's certainly her testimony,
and
that she feared his attack when he came into the house.
And she gun in the bathroom?
She knew where the house, no, the gun was in the holster. As she passed the closet, she picked up the gun.
She knew the gun was in the bathroom.
The gun was in the holster in the closet.
She knew that?
Yes.
That's why she went into the bathroom?
No. The gun was in the closet, not in the bathroom. She went into the bathroom in an attempt to escape. But that point is really moot in light of my argument, which is that there's no duty to retreat when you're attacked in one's own home. Additionally, the fact that she retreated was not recognized by the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals seems to imply that there should have been some springing duty of retreat that sprung up between the fourth shot and the fifth shot, when he, although he was still threatening her, did not come at her after being shot twice.
Did she shoot him when he would not let her leave the jail?
She shot two warning shots, one into the ceiling, one into the floor. He continued to advance towards her, threatening her, calling her a dead bitch and a few other things, at which point she shot another
shot
into his arms. The coroner testified that none of the shots were immediately incapacitating, that there was not much blood, and in fact that the trailer shows that at some point he attempted to rise up from the wall. She went over to assist him between the fourth shot and fifth shot. At that point, when she went over to assist him, he continued to threaten her. At that point, she shot two more times and went around him outside the door.
Where did she shoot?
She shot with a .22 caliber pistol.
Where?
In the arm, two times. The third and fourth shot was in the arm, one of which ricocheted in the abdomen. The last two shots, after he's down but still threatening her, are in the lower back and the upper back.
He was down and getting up, wasn't he? Was that a way?
Yeah,
sort of stooping.
He was down and getting up and continuing to threaten her. And that may well be an issue of excessive force, but that's not the issue here. The issue here is that this jury should not have been instructed that there was a duty to retreat, and that they had to find that there was no.
Wasn't the appellee, the state makes the argument that the instruction that the judge gave really benefited your client, perhaps more than the instruction would have benefited your client that you requested. What's your
response?
That's
in the second proposition of law.
You don't want to go to that yet. I didn't mean to jump ahead, but I did. You ready to go to that proposition?
I was going to bring that up, but you really can't separate the battered woman syndrome from your first issue anyway, so I guess we're
excited.
Actually, I would disagree. I think that the law is clear on the first issue, and it's not a special rule for battered women syndrome.
I understand, but
okay.
It even heightens
it does
your
heighten
position
it.
Because of her position as a battered woman.
Imposing a duty to retreat disproportionately affects battered women in light of the fact that there's separation assault and statistics that show that, and in light of the fact that most battering incidents occur within the home.
Well, in fact, she was a joint owner of the house. Is that correct or not?
They moved, I believe they... I don't know that they purchased
sure
the trailer together, but there certainly was no issue that regarding whether she lived there or not. Even his mother testified she moved in several weeks before this incident. As to the second proposition of law, appellant asserts that when an accused asserts self-defense and offers sufficient evidence that she suffered from the battered woman syndrome, a jury instruction tailored to that syndrome is required. This court has dealt, at least in argument, with this issue in State versus Dawes. The state, Chief Justice Moore, you asked regarding whether the instruction that was given was actually beneficial to the client, which is what the Court of Appeals found. I don't think it was beneficial for a couple of reasons. First of all, the instruction gave no guidelines to determine what is a battered woman. There's no definition in the instruction that was given by the court, so it's not in accordance with Ohio law, nor does it, by virtue of not defining battered women, mean that it made that finding.
That was my point. It seems to me that the definition of battered woman and that was in the request instruction, one that has been given, gives this these criteria that have to be met. And here, it seemed to me that the jury could easily find, with expert testimony, could perhaps more easily find that she was a battered woman under the sort of general battered woman or self-defense with a battered woman element in an instruction than having to meet these criteria twice or more than twice exposed.
Some jurors may well have found it easier. On the other hand, without any guidelines whatsoever, particularly given the complexity of the syndrome, they may have said, you know, I don't know what a battered woman is. I don't know what to do with expert testimony.
Wasn't that an argument for counsel for not giving a definition in the instruction, because it's really expert testimony that the Chief Justice suggests that defines battered women syndrome? You may have variance among experts about how you expect that to define it. So for a court to latch on to one particular definition, as you say, it's a very complex syndrome. So they have everybody puts on this kind of defense, presents expert testimony to assist the jurors, because that's not something that's in our everyday experience, and there you have it. So if you find, and now it's become a term of art for that tribe, battered women syndrome. Now they say, if you find, you know, here's what you do with battered women syndrome.
But without any guidelines to find whether you're a battered woman or not.
We don't define in trials, and there are quite a few things that we say, yep, you know that now because we explained it to you. Just as a medical expert, you know, if you find the complainant suffered this, you know, this disease, but we don't put it in the instruction about how one determines whether the
that's correct.
Has a disease.
We don't, but this case is different. This is the only time when psychiatric testimony going to state of mind is admissible. This is a different type of self-defense in essence. It's
how does that, I'm still not sure how that bears on putting the definition in the instruction.
The law requires under Costin and the statute that the defendant be found to be a battered woman, and that then the expert testimony is admissible. In order to find the defendant to be a battered woman, you have to define it. You have to define it. To have an expert just testify, these are some of the characteristics, these are some of the characteristics, there's no guidelines given to a jury to determine whether there are sufficient characteristics here to find that she's a battered woman. Next, the court, given the complexity of the syndrome and the fact that it goes to the second element of self-defense, the subjective, reasonable belief of imminent danger, the jury has to be given some guidance as to how to apply that. It's not a separate defense. It is, in fact, it merely goes to the subjective, reasonable belief of imminent fear. The jury has no understanding of that with the kind of instruction that was given in this case. All that was given in this case is, you may consider it. Well, consider it in what manner? How do I consider it? What do I do with it? What if I don't believe it? What if I don't even think she's a battered woman? How do I consider it? The jury has to be given some instruction if it's pertinent to the issues, if it's not covered by the general charge, and if there's sufficient evidence established under State versus Hicks. All of those criteria were met here. And certainly, I think this court has recognized how difficult this syndrome is. It's recognized it in
State
versus Hicks.
You say that
Cox.
It's difficult. Have we arrived at such a point scientifically that there is one definition for a battered woman syndrome? Can a court easily give a definition that will fit all cases?
Probably not. There is not a general definition that's accepted by all groups. And I'm not asking this court to write an instruction that is a cookbook for OJI. It may well differ in certain cases, but a correct, proper instruction that is pertinent to the issues, that goes along with the evidence that was submitted in that case, like here, where there was testimony about the cyclical nature, and certainly that is an element that seems to be recognized as a key element of battered woman syndrome. That's when the instruction has to be given. I'll reserve the remainder of my time for the question.
Thank you, Ms. Wright. Mr. Mr. Biddleston.
May it please the court, we would request that the court affirm the Court of Appeals decision regarding both the duty to retreat, that it was, if it was error, it was harmless error, and also in the jury instruction was adequate regarding battered woman syndrome.
I was persuaded by Justice Cardozo's observation that was cited in the reply. He said, one retreat from his own house when assailed by a partner or co-tenant, when any more than one assailed by a stranger who was lawfully upon the premises, whither shall he flee, and how far, and when, and may be permitted to return, when may be permitted to return. Why isn't that the sentiment, or at least the policy that we should apply with the duty to retreat? Why should it make any difference whether it's a co-inhabitant or whether it's an intruder? Isn't the home the last place that most people think is safe, even though it oftentimes isn't? But isn't that the belief?
Yeah, I believe the purpose of the retreat rule in general is to eliminate the risk of physical violence and physical harm. If we don't allow that rule to apply to cohabitants who both have equal right to be in that location, then we're in a sense encouraging physical violence and physical harm. I understand what Justice Cardozo was saying, but I also understand what some of the other courts in Rhode Island and New Jersey have said as well, that the purpose is to prevent violent activity and to discourage violent activity. And if people have a safe avenue of escape from physical violence or resorting to physical violence, they ought to take that prior to resorting to the use of physical force.
Well, that sure sounds good, and I mean, who could dispute that we shouldn't encourage people to be shooting each other in their own homes, even though they're in their own house. But the other argument, as you know as well, if someone retreats, particularly if a woman runs out, retreats, there's this phenomenon of the man, she's a bad woman, the man's going to come after her. And now we're out in the public with people shooting at each other. Now that may be a bad reason to say stay in your own house, but there are lots of converging currents here, are there not? And I guess that's why Cardozo's sort of simple kind of logic here is somewhat persuasive to me.
Yes, and in that situation, however, there may be no available safe means of retreat. In this particular case, I think the Court of Appeals was correct in that the defendant made no effort to retreat whatsoever. She had, at some point, moved the gun into the bedroom, into the holster, because her mother was there an hour earlier and testified it was in the kitchen in her pocketbook. She knew where the gun was. She went into the bedroom. He never entered the bedroom. He never got close to the bedroom.
Well, but here's a woman who had been battered. He was threatening her again to kill her. She goes in the bathroom and says that she couldn't get out the small window. What is she to do? He's standing in her way, apparently, to get so she can't get out of the house. What does she do? I mean, this is a pretty good case of battered woman. A battered woman, or that's a syndrome, I don't know, but she sure has been battered by him, both physically and, excuse me, mentally. And now we're going to say you got to run out of the house. Why?
Your Honor, I just have to disagree that this is a good case indicating that she was a battered woman at all.
Okay, maybe I misread it.
In the evidence there, the only statements indicated she suffered battered woman syndrome on her own. There was no corroborating evidence presented to the court whatsoever. For instance, she indicated there had been two instances of abuse. There was no medical reports, even that she actually ever been to the hospital regarding those incidents. At one point, she claimed that she had to go to her grandmother's house to avoid him, that he came and chased her down there. There was no testimony of anybody at her grandmother's house saying he ever came there and chased her down.
Well, okay, I probably shouldn't have said
spent this on
facts, but the law, I mean, the question is, what's the law? Is the jury going to be told if you do find that even though there wasn't a lot of corroborating evidence about her injuries and so forth, but if you find, jury, that she's a battered woman, or at minimum that she could engage in self-defense, do we still tell the jury that she had a duty to retreat?
Well,
from her own home.
I think she has to take any available safe way out of the situation before a person resorts to deadly force. I think by taking a contrary position, you're not only talking about battered woman syndrome cases, you're talking about any co-tenant situation or cohabitant situation.
Didn't the Court of Appeals say retreat to the wall? In other words, the retreat is that you cannot attack someone, a cohabitant, battered and cohabitant, cannot take that attack as a place to attack back, have back off. And retreat to the wall is what we call it. So maybe that doesn't mean to leave your home.
I would agree with that to the extent practicable. If there's a practical means to escape the danger, to escape the harm, to escape the confrontation, a person should be required to take that. If that is going to within the next room and closing and locking the door to try to avoid the danger, then that's the steps a person should take to do that.
But this is what's being argued here. Make this case far more widespread, more pervasive than it appears at first blush. It seems to me the argument is, when you're in your own home, you have no duty to retreat. And that's the argument on the other side. I tried to get a distinction between cohabitants. The counselor said there was no distinction. Now, hasn't the rule always been, she points out, she says the rule has always been you don't have to retreat in your own home. That's not my understanding of the law. Do you have to retreat? I mean, that's what this case is about. I think if we reverse this case, we simply say anybody under attack in your own home or under threat in your own home, or the second prong of self-defense is met, you're under imminent threat of danger, has no duty to retreat.
I agree with Your Honor, yes.
Isn't that what is the result of this case if you reverse?
I believe that is.
Is that the law?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because I think Peacock and Williford also indicated the intent there was it was an intruder coming into the home, somebody that had no right to be there. Somebody was threatened from the outside of a person within his castle, within his home, and within his sanctuary. It wasn't somebody from within attacking, it was somebody from without.
She's willing to concede there's no distinction, I think she is, when I ask her, that there's no distinction between cohabitants and somebody coming from the outside. And her distinction, of course, is that once he starts doing an illegal act, he isn't any longer a person who is entitled to be there. So if there's no distinction, my problem with this whole argument is that I think we're about to change the law of several hundred years. That if there is no duty to retreat, if you're under attack in your own home, now maybe that's what the law ought to be. But isn't that a change in the law?
I believe that would be a change, Your Honor, yes. I think that's what we argued in our brief, which was a modification of the Castle Doctrine. Actually, because the Castle Doctrine implies somebody externally coming in my reading of those early cases, and in that common law theory. And this would definitely be changing that, requiring no duty to retreat under any circumstances in application. And I think it also, again, doesn't address the issue that if they were out in the yard battling the same two people, there is a duty, and it makes a very difficult and inconsistent
I suppose the question you got asked as much as anything when you were in practice is it so if somebody starts to come through your door, shoot them, and then drag them across the threshold? I mean, how many times have we as lawyers been asked that question? Is that what I have to do? Shoot them on the front porch and then drag them into the living room.
Mm-hmm.
And my advice always was that ain't what the law is. We had the duty to retreat. Now, it's always bothered me that you have to run out of your own house or run into a closet where you're defenseless in order to get your back to the wall, but that's always been my understanding of what the law was.
Do you agree with that, Counselor? I thought the law was that you didn't have a duty to retreat, but if there's an intruder, we have a difference, I guess, here. Do you agree? I'm curious whether you agree with that.
My understanding would be that you don't have a duty to retreat in your own home.
Yeah, that's true. I thought
an external intruder.
However, and we're being asked to extend that for Cardozo to say we don't apply that just to an intruder, but you don't have a duty to retreat if you cohabit in the house and violence occurs. The Court of Appeals has taken the middle ground and say, well, you go to the wall, you don't go outside, but you, if you go to the wall, whatever that, not sure exactly what that means, but I guess literally it means you find, try to find a safe place in the house, I guess. And then the next step would be that that you don't have a duty to go anyplace.
Right, I think
or you have to flee.
To retreat to the extent practical under the circumstances is what's required. That's what I think should be required in Ohio. I don't agree necessarily that if your attacker's on the front porch and you shoot him and pull him in, that's clearly not. I mean, you really have to wait till it's actually a threat, because you still have first and second prong of the self-defense issue, even on an outside intruder coming in. There has to be actually a threat of imminent harm. So if he's still outside and hasn't entered your premises yet, then I wonder that you have that you're right to use violent force regardless of duty to retreat or not at that point, because the other two prongs of the self-defense argument are maintained. And I want to just touch on the second argument regarding the battered woman syndrome instruction. The state believes that the instruction given by the court was adequate. Our opinion is that it adequately stated the law in Ohio. The proper instruction, we believe, would have imposed a greater duty on the defendant, because they would have had to demonstrate that she was a battered woman. If you find those two incidents, battering had occurred prior, the two prior cycles had occurred. The big difference between State versus Koss and Ng and Dawes in our cases, those cases didn't allow battered woman syndrome testimony at all, much less an instruction at all on that issue. Our case allowed, I think it was 4.5 to 5 hours of battered woman syndrome testimony with direct and cross-examination. The instruction correctly stated, or adequately correctly stated, the 29106 standard of what battered woman syndrome testimony could be used and applied for in a self-defense case. And therefore, I think there was nothing an error about the instruction provided by the court in this particular case. If there's no further questions, I think I have no further argument.
Thank you very much. Ms. Wright, you saved a minute of your time.
I disagree with you, Justice Douglas. I believe there is no duty to retreat whatsoever when you're attacked in your own home.
You rely on Peacock for that.
I rely on Peacock. I rely
doesn't
on people
that mean
be
that
Tomlins?
You don't have to retreat from the home? Because if you go all the way back to the, well, I mean, a later case for us in 79, State v. Robbins, where it specifically points out that she must not have violated any duty to retreat to avoid the danger. That's a 1979 case.
State
Peacock was 1883, and meant, I think, that you don't have to leave the house.
And if you go on to State v. Williford, this court said there is no duty to retreat when attacked in your own home. The second element, we may be getting confused because there are two other elements in self-defense that still need to be proved. And that is that she didn't create the situation and she had an imminent fear of harm. And the use of force was her only means of escape. The use of force being her only means of escape is somewhat confusing in terms of the duty to retreat, I believe. I get it confused in my mind. But to me, what it means is there doesn't have to be a physical retreat when you're in your own home. You may have to try and calm the situation down, but you don't have to retreat from the use of force if you're being physically attacked. I think that's what the law is, and I think it was very clearly stated by Justice Cardoza and People v. Thomas, regardless of the status of the attacker. It makes no sense to craft some law that says if it's someone that has a right to be there, if it's an invitee or cohabitant, there's some lesser duty. The anomalies that are created by that are absurd. It means I can shoot a boyfriend I don't live with that attacks me in my home, but I can't if I do live with him, assuming the other elements of self-defense are met. I believe the law is very clear regarding the no duty to retreat. And I also think that it's very easy to get this confused when you say battling cohabitants, Justice Cook. This was not a mutual combat situation. This isn't battling cohabitants. This is a self-defense claim by a defendant who was attacked. She still has those other two elements to prove before self-defense is going to be, before it's going to win, before it's going to work. You have to show that you didn't create the situation. This isn't mutual combat. You also have to show you had a reasonable fear of imminent harm, and it was the use of force was the only means of escape.
You've used your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. The marshal, please turn to the floor.